We are extraordinarily blessed in the United States to have a great democracy, as the events in the Middle East remind us, I think, very, very clearly again. And not only a great democracy, but a democracy that was written by some of the greatest geniuses in political theory, particularly James Madison, who understood that power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, and the name of the game really is checks and balances and separation of powers. In that vein, we very much were beholden to the framers for having an independent Supreme Court of the United States that has an extraordinarily important role in policing a number of the fundamental provisions of the Constitution and separation of powers and checks and balances that might otherwise not be self-policing. Just to run through some of the more important, the whole notion of federalism. Federalism might easily be set aside by a federal government that simply assumes all of the powers. The second is the question of separation of powers generally between the branches of the federal government, the executive versus the Congress of the United States, and indeed even the powers of the court. A third relates to the protection of the individual from the state. This is what we associate particularly with Bill of Rights and, let's say, activism of the Warren Court. And a fourth that is equally critical in the functioning of a strong democracy is the integrity of the electoral process. And there are a number of differing kinds of challenges to the integrity of the electoral process. We're looking at one of those today, of the whole question of campaign finance and campaign finance reform. But, for example, the whole question of gerrymandering, which is critically important and in which the Supreme Court has from time to time engaged in the issue. Both to deal with it in terms of trying to prevent simply incumbents protecting themselves or one or another political party trying to get advantage from the process. Some have been looking at in recent years the question of how well we are served by the primary system of both parties in the selection of presidential candidates, with arguments being made, for example, that the current primary system and the way it works out is actually encouraging the extremes of both parties. Today, however, we are coming to another critical issue, that of the legislation that's been enacted dealing with campaign finance and the interaction of the courts, and particularly, most recently, Citizens United case that this panel is focused on. Now, let me just try to stir the pot here a little bit, because the core of the work of this panel is going to be really to look at what is the impact of Citizens United. What happened? Hopefully, we'll have some good data. We'll be looking at this, some good argumentation, so that the core of it certainly and I think the expectations of our panelists is to be looking at this question of what is the immediate impact on the political process and the integrity of that process. But I'd like at least to leave on the table the broader picture, if I might. And that is to remind us that there really are two very differing camps about this question of whether campaign finance legislation is in fact something that is part of the solution to integrity of the political process or part of the problem to integrity of the political process. On the one hand, we see strong arguments that it is part of the solution because there is a perception of corruption that needs to be rebutted, or there may be actual corruption that might result if we did not have the laws. Or we would like to reduce the amount of time that political candidates have to engage in raising money. And I would add to that, while those are some of the principal arguments actually made to the courts, the one I think the public generally buys into and believes on this, which is it really is designed to lessen the impact of money and to achieve, quote, greater equality in relation to the political process. On the other side, we see equally strong arguments that, in the first place, remind us that the first of these acts passed in 1907, the Tillman Act, was at the behest of a very racist former governor of South Carolina, who was in the Senate at that point, who sought to ban the payment of corporations, contributions by corporations to the political process, precisely because it was against his agenda, which was highly racist, and he did not want those corporations from the North at that point to be able to be making contributions that might, in fact, undermine his extremely racist message at that point. I won't even quote his various comments that he was fond of making. I think he'd also attacked another senator at one point. This was quite a colorful character. That was the first one passed. So we ought to be thinking about that a little bit in terms of the background. Those on that side of the equation would also argue that this is primarily designed, in fact, to protect incumbents, and that we ought to look at what they say is really an obvious point here. And there is a wonderful story about not overlooking the obvious that let me share with you at this point. And it is Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson going camping one evening in their tent under the stars. And in the middle of the night, Sherlock Holmes nudges Watson and he says, Watson, look up at all those stars up there. What do you deduce? And a sleepy Watson looks up and says, well, there must be billions of stars up there. Perhaps there are other planets, and perhaps there's life up there on some other planet. And Holmes looks at him disdainfully and says, Watson, you idiot, someone stole our tent. Well, the obvious point here is that everyone that votes for campaign finance laws and legislatures that pass them are incumbents. Think about that for a moment in relation to it. Now, there are other arguments, too, on that side. I don't want to go fully into that. But I do think we ought to sort of have on the table as well, if we might, after we have sort of the more specific discussion here, let's look at, have the full debate as well, of the broadest picture. Do campaign finance laws help in terms of the overall integrity of the political process, or, in fact, are they part of the problem? Now, our first speaker is going to be Mark Elias, who is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Perkins Coe. Focuses his practice on representing public elected officials, candidates, parties, corporations, and PACs. He has served as lead counsel for Senator Al Franken in 2008 in the Minnesota Senate election recount and contest, which was the largest in American history. He argued that case successfully before the Minnesota State Supreme Court that resulted in a unanimous decision. That has to be particularly gratifying to get a unanimous decision out of a Supreme Court. 2004, he served as general counsel of the Kerry Edwards presidential campaign, served in that same capacity for Chris Dodd for president during the 2008 primary campaign, and he's a graduate of Duke University School of Law and Hamilton College. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Mark Elias.
Thank you for the introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here today. I usually, Don McGann and I have known each other a long time and oftentimes find ourselves in common circumstances. And I used to be able to say reliably that there were two things that were always the case. One is that he would never cut his hair, and second is I would never wear a suit. Don has gone back on his half of the bargain, but I promise you I haven't gone back on mine. So let me start with where I think Citizens United fits into the landscape of the 2010 cycle, a little bit before that, and where we're going from here. And there is no question that Citizens United was a very important decision. I mean, there just isn't. And unlike some of the other folks who will speak to you today, including some of the figures that the Sunlight Foundation put out that Commissioner McGann referred to, that others will talk about, I don't need facts and figures to know this. In addition to other clients, I also represent a large number of Senate campaigns, a number of House candidates. And anyone who was looking at individual races in 2010 could tell you that there really isn't any doubt that Citizens United made a big difference in the amount of outside group spending that took place in 2010. The problem with the facts and figures, I will just start, and I've done this on other panel discussions before, is exactly what Don McGann mentioned, which is it's always hard to know what they're talking, you know, comparing apples and oranges. Are you talking about just independent expenditures? Are you talking about electioneering communications? Are you talking about ads run by just five 501c organizations, by 527s, by federal PACs, by party committees? But what I can tell you is that Karl Rove and I almost never agree on anything, and on this we agree. Okay? I mean, in some respects, when I hear conservatives talk about Citizens United not being that significant, I almost think they're being bashful. I mean, the fact is that Crossroads and Crossroads GPS and American Action Network and a large number of other organizations, or a significant number of other organizations, primarily on the right, with some exception on the left, in 2010, took advantage of the legal regime as it exists in the post-Citizens United world. And at conferences like this, like I said, every so often I get the impression that conservative academics are sort of bashful about this. And they want to say, well, you know, Citizens United really didn't do that much. It did. It changed things in a profound way, which I think shouldn't be overlooked by focusing in on specific facts and figures. So let me give you the two ways that I think it made a big difference. First, it changed the psychology. And as much as anything else, Citizens United has become a symbol for not one court case, but actually a series of court decisions that came in rapid succession. So Citizens United, as you heard other panelists discuss, stood for the relatively narrow proposition that corporations can make independent expenditures, namely, say, vote for, vote against, elect, defeat, support, oppose, and that they could make electioneering communications within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general election. What had happened, and you saw some of this in the statistics that Don mentioned, was prior to Citizens United, if you go back to 2004, you had a large number of organizations that were not incorporated, that did not take corporate money, or took corporate money but didn't use it for certain kinds of expenditures. They were referred to as 527s. Remember, we used to do conferences. Before I did an endless series of conferences about Citizens United, I did a similarly endless series of conferences about 527s. 527s were before Citizens United. There were 527s that would run independent media. And in 2004, there were a number of them that were quite large and quite active. The Federal Election Commission, following the 2004 cycle, I might add, by the way, in part based on complaints filed by the Bush campaign and by the Republican National Committee, the FEC sought to clamp down on outside group spending by 527s. Which is why, if you listen to the statistics that Don McGann gave you, you saw in 06 a precipitous drop in that spending. And that was the result of two things. One, presidential, not being in a presidential cycle. Number two, the fact was that there was a nervousness among donors and a nervousness among operators that doing outside group spending was legally risky or at a minimum very complicated. What Citizens United did was it took that risky, complicated cloud and set it aside. So that what the Supreme Court's decision did was really change the psychology. It became much easier for donors to understand, for outside, for operatives to understand that they could set up an organization that could raise unlimited funds, that could spend those funds, and as long as they were not coordinating with candidates, they did not have to worry about getting a letter from the Federal Election Commission saying that there is reason to believe that you may have violated the federal campaign finance laws. So that's the first big change that Citizens United had. The second big change that it had was, and this I think was actually quite accidental, but it had the effect of pushing money from disclosed places into undisclosed places. Remember the 527s I mentioned that everyone talked about and complained about in 2004? How did we know that George Soros funded the pro-Kerry 527? How did we know who was there were some Texas billionaires behind Swift Boat Veterans for Truth? The answer is because 527s actually had to disclose all their donors. If you gave to a 527 or a 527 spent money, it was disclosed on the public record. Same as if you gave money to a federally registered political committee with the FEC. Different disclosure, one to the IRS, one to the FEC, but it was all disclosed money. The other main impact of Citizens United was to create a much more central role for 501c organizations to play a bigger role than they had previously played in campaign advertising. That doesn't mean they hadn't played any. The Chamber of Commerce is a 501c, the NRA is a 501c, Sierra Club is a 501c. So I don't mean to suggest that had not existed before, but what all of those have in common, the NRA, the Sierra Club, and the AFL-CIO, are also all corporations, whereas most 527s were unincorporated. Most 501c's are incorporated. So the other big impact of the Citizens United decision was, as I said, I think quite accidentally, I think if you actually go back and look at what Karl Rove and Ed Gillespie and others did initially in the 2010 cycle, they actually were intending to set up disclosed vehicles. SpeechNow, which was an organization created that brought one of these lawsuits, was set up to disclose all of its funds. But I think over time what evolved during the 2010 cycle was the notion that that 501c organizations, and in particular 501c4 organizations, could play a more central role where there was not disclosure. So I think if you look at what did Citizens United mean, it means that what does it mean going forward? It means we're going to have a lot more outside spending. We're going to have a lot more outside spending relative to parties. We're going to have a lot more outside spending relative to campaigns. And that trend will continue. And I also suspect that the battle line will be drawn going forward over disclosure, over whether or not it is a good thing or a bad thing that that independent expenditures can be run at where the public is unaware whose donations are being used to fund those activities. So in a nutshell, that's my 5 to 7 minute version or 10 minute version of what I think Citizens United has meant for the 2010 cycle. And I think for those of you looking towards 2012, you should just assume there's going to be more of it. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Elias. And our next speaker is Trevor Potter. Trevor Potter is a member in Kaplan and Drysdale's Washington, D.C. office, where he leads the firm's political activity law practice. He is a former commissioner and chairman of the Federal Election Commission. He served as general counsel to the Rick Scott 2010 gubernatorial campaign, as well as the John McCain 2008 and 2000 presidential campaigns. He also served as deputy general counsel for the George H.W. Bush 1988 campaign. He is the founding president and general counsel of the Campaign Legal Center, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit which focuses on campaign finance issues in the courts and before the FEC. He is a graduate of Harvard College, and I'm delighted and proud to say, of the University of Virginia School of Law. Mr. Potter.
Thank you very much. For those in the audience who don't know either me or some of the lineups here, I'm going to do you a favor and relieve you of some confusion. You might have thought, based on the titles, that Mark Elias was going to give the Democratic view, I'm going to give the Republican view, and then John of Cato is going to give the sort of in-the-middle-of-the-road nonpartisan approach. Well, as always in life, you know, we wear different hats, and there are lots of subcurrents. So Mark gave, I think, appropriately the Democratic view. I am going to give the reaction of somebody who worked with Senator McCain in helping conceive the legal theories behind and some of the details of McCain-Feingold, and comes from the wing of the Republican Party, more accurately, perhaps historically represented by Teddy Roosevelt than by some of the current congressional leadership, in terms of thinking that as citizens we need to be concerned about the undue influence of money in politics and the legislative decision-making process. And so that's a long disclaimer by way of saying that my is a Republican view, but not the Republican view. As the FEC speaker said this morning, I thought magnificently, I'm not speaking on behalf of any other living person. So I will give you a perspective from that side of things. There is a, first of all, it's great to be back at UVA. It may only be at the University of Virginia Law School that we would be able to assemble a group this size to take as seriously these matters on the first beautiful day of spring when we could all be outdoors. So I think does reflect well on the Journal of Law and Politics to have put this together and to give us an opportunity to discuss what are, after all, issues central to our democracy and our system of government. There is, in the center of a certain university well to the north of us, a very prominent statue. And it's a figure of a man sitting in a chair. And it has on it engraving. It has three lines. And it is the joy of every student tour guide taking tours around the center of that university to stop and to say, this is the statue of the three lies. The statue says on it, John Harvard, founder, 1636. And the tour guides say, that isn't John Harvard, he wasn't the founder, and this place wasn't founded in 1636. I notice over here we have a statue of Thomas Jefferson, and wisely and modestly, the University of Virginia has chosen to write nothing on it at all. That means people can't complain and point out the three lies. To me, Citizens United is a case of the three lies. The first, which was discussed this morning, and so I will pass on very quickly, is that the issue of corporate spending and the general issue of overturning Austin was squarely before the court and had to be decided. That'll be a great issue for students in jurisprudence classes for years to come, but I admit the court would have gotten to that case at some point. A case like it would have been brought where it would have been argued and not withdrawn below. So the court would have gotten at some stage, particularly this court, which clearly had five justices that didn't like the state of jurisprudence, would have gotten there at some point. The second lie is that we were dealing with a ban on corporate speech, that corporations were prohibited from exercising their First Amendment rights. I think a number of speakers have correctly pointed out that corporations have First Amendment rights. The question is, exactly what are they, and are they coterminous with individual rights, and are there no differences? And the court has a long, not entirely clear, history of jurisprudence making exceptions and delineating where they are coterminous and where they are not. I would just note, because I think it's relevant to the notion that this is a entirely new world of jurisprudence that prior to Citizens United, corporations could establish and administer PACs, political action committees, spend corporate money to raise individual contributions, could control those, could decide which candidates they gave to, could use them to make independent expenditures, all with the corporate name on them, could engage in unlimited internal communications about candidates with shareholders and executives, could engage in public communication on ballot referenda or issue advertising that didn't expressly advocate a candidate's election or defeat or was outside of the electioneering communication periods. Nonprofit corporations, if they met, they were C4s meeting the Massachusetts Citizens for Life exemption, could engage in fact, express advocacy in general corporate, general public communication. And finally, of course, executives, shareholders, anyone else associated with a corporation could themselves go out in their own capacity and speak without limit. So I think it is both sides had an interest in overstating the legal notion that there was a ban on corporate speech. I don't think that was true. It's particularly relevant here because, to me, the court gave the back of its hand, the majority, to the idea that a PAC had anything to do with this. There's an extraordinary line in the majority opinion saying that PACs basically aren't controlled by corporations and don't speak for them. Contrary to case law, contrary to reality, they gave corporations a way to speak, but not complete speech. And it seemed to me that that was one way in which the corporate First Amendment rights pre-Citizens United have been balanced. But today we're here to look at what I think is the third lie, and that affects everything going forward. What is the effect of this decision going to be? What was it in 2010? What will it be from now on? And that has to do with the aspects of disclosure and corporate governance. Justice Kennedy, speaking for eight members of the court, was at pains to say that this decision wouldn't, in some ways, have a huge effect because it was going to be cushioned by the fact that all this spending would be disclosed and that corporate shareholders would know what their corporations were doing and could object if they didn't like it. There's a three-page section of the opinion, but one of the lines Justice Kennedy wrote, again speaking for eight of the nine members of the court, was, "With the advent of the Internet, prompt disclosure of expenditures can provide shareholders and citizens with the information needed to hold corporations and elected officials accountable for their positions and supporters. Shareholders can determine whether their corporation's political speech advances the corporation's interest in making profits, and citizens can see whether elected officials are, quote, in the pocket of so-called moneyed interests." So we have here, and I take Justice Kennedy's writing at face value, I think he believed, as he said elsewhere in the opinion, that today, for the first time, corporations can speak in federal elections, and such speech will be fully disclosed. I think he also believed that shareholders will be able to judge and presumably affect whether their corporate expenditures are appropriate. And yet that is not what anyone took away from the 2010 election. I used to speculate last fall, as there were daily stories about all of this undisclosed spending, that Justice Kennedy must be walking around in circles in his chambers saying to his clerks, "Where did this come from? That's not what I was told." So let's take a quick look at how we got where we are. I think Mark did a good job of pointing out that there was a transfer in 2010 because the world is full of good lawyers who think around the corner and to the next problem. The FEC having pushed, over a series of time, 527s have been created. Their spending then limited by the FEC, and I think crucially, their spending being reported with contributors on the public record at the IRS. In 2010, what we saw was a move of significant amounts of money to spending through 501c4s and c6s. which are in many ways solely distinguished for these purposes by the fact that donors need not be publicly disclosed, so that the general public will know the amounts being raised because that's reported to the IRS, the amounts spent on electioneering communications because those communications are reported under McCain-Feingold to the FEC, but, and I will discuss it in a little detail, not the identity of the donors. Now, C4s and C6s do not publicly disclose to the IRS their donors. The question is, when they run campaign ads, independent expenditures, which they now can under Citizens United, or electioneering communications, which they can under Citizens United, in the windows mentioning a candidate, should they have to disclose their donors on their FEC forms? Let me just give you a perspective on this. And these are numbers that came from a Public Citizen review of electioneering communication filings at the FEC. In 2004, 98% of all election communication reports identified the donors, the funders of the communication. In 2006, 97% identified the donors or funders. In 2010, 31%. And I would venture to say that's 31% who had not consulted their lawyers closely. And in 2012, that will be maybe 1%. Why is that? The statute says, McCain-Feingold, that there are two ways to take money in and spend it on electioneering communications. Again, this is a statute written assuming corporations wouldn't do it, but it's to all electioneering communications. What we now know post-Citizens United is corporations can make those as well. It says either you can have a segregated fund, in which case you don't have to disclose all your donors. You just have to disclose the people who give to that segregated fund. Then you use that fund to purchase your electioneering communications. If you do that model, you disclose donors of over $1,000 to that fund. If you don't have such a separate fund, then you disclose all contributors who contribute an aggregate amount of $1,000 or more to the person making the disbursement from the preceding day, from the first day of the preceding calendar year. Now, the FEC, as other speakers have noted, Chairman McGann, I think in particular, changed this standard when it amended its regulations in 2007. They kept the $1,000 and so forth, but they added a qualifying phrase, which is that the contribution was made for the purpose of furthering electioneering communications, which is not in the statute, even as a concept. But what it meant for the first time is that somebody could say, in theory, I gave money to the organization, it went into its general treasury fund, but it wasn't for electioneering communications, so you shouldn't identify me. Now, I can safely say that what the drafters had in mind was you had two choices. You could do a separate segregated fund if you didn't want to disclose all your donors, or you could disclose everyone who gave you more than $1,000. That was there precisely to deal with the possibility that there are people who wanted to give to the Sierra Club or the NRA, but not for electioneering communications, or didn't want to be disclosed, in which case their money wouldn't be used for electioneering communications. But the FEC gave us that extra gloss. Presumably, that would at least cover organizations where the organization goes out and says, we're going to do advertising in this year. We need to elect Democrats or Republicans or defeat Senator Smith, and we need your money, because then you would know they're doing electioneering communications. So along comes Freedom's Watch, which was a group that ran approximately $30 million of advertising, electioneering communications, in 2008. And there was an article in the New York Times citing anonymous sources, but according to the article, multiple anonymous sources, which said that Freedom's Watch was really controlled by one person who gave $29,850,000 of the $30 million. and had control over the advertising and the organization. And yet Freedom's Watch didn't list that individual on their FEC reports as being a donor. And three commissioners took the view that there had been no proof that these funds were given for the specific purpose of running the specific electioneering communication, which was being disclosed on that form. And therefore, there need be no disclosure of the donor. The Freedom's Watch organization said the funds had been given for, quote, general purposes of support. Now, you could look at this from a variety of ways, one of which is if it appears the organization only existed to do electioneering communications, then even general support should require the disclosure of that donor. You could also look at it practically and say, you know, this is going to be an impossible to meet standard because, in my experience, nobody ever makes an advertisement until they have somebody to pay for it. So if the standard is you have to see the ad and say, I want to run that ad and pay for it, so I will give you $30 million, we are unlikely to end up with disclosure of that donor. But I don't think you have to go that far into the weeds. I think you could stop with the fact that this is all very interesting, but it's not what the statute says. And I agree with Commissioner McGann that there are times when the statute has been overruled by the courts, and so you can't look at what the statute says because the courts have told you that the statute is invalid. But here, the statute was upheld. In Citizens United, the court says 8-1 that even though corporations can spend this money, they still have to disclose the sources of the money of their electioneering communications, and that's to a specific challenge where Citizens United says, we don't want to tell you who our donors are. And the court says, sorry, you have to. It's what the statute says, and we find 8-1 it is fully constitutional. So, where do we go from there? I agree we're going to have a lot of discussion over the next years about disclosure and the very good questions raised so far of who discloses what and what the limits are and so forth. I have to say there are times that I disagree with Justice Scalia. This is not one of them. He discussed disclosure requirements in Doe v. Reed, and he ended up saying, there are laws against threats and intimidation, and harsh criticism, short of unlawful action, is a price our people have traditionally been willing to pay for self-governance. Requiring people to stand up in public for their political acts fosters civic courage, without which democracy is doomed. For my part, I do not look forward to a society which, thanks to the Supreme Court, campaigns anonymously, McIntyre, and even exercises the direct democracy of initiative and referendum, hidden from public scrutiny and protected from the accountability of criticism. This does not resemble the home of the brave. So I think Justice Scalia is a loud voice, whether he's going to be the controlling voice, I don't know, in saying that we want disclosure for all the reasons the 8-1 majority said as Citizens United, and generally that disclosure has to come even at the price of someone criticizing you. Now, I know I'm out of time, so I will make my second point in conclusion. The second point is, in addition to disclosure, Justice Kennedy talked about shareholder control. And all I can say is that where is Justice Powell when we need him? A justice who actually knew something about corporate law. Mark has gone to endless Citizens United panels. I've gone to endless panels about corporate law since Citizens United was decided. And all these corporate law professors say, we don't know what they were smoking, but shareholders do not control corporate decisions on political spending. Directors control them. Shareholders are not responsible to directors for such decisions. The business judgment rule makes that really clear. Shareholders have enough trouble even getting a resolution through that says you ought to disclose this. When they do, political spending is defined narrowly as giving to candidates or party committees, and it doesn't include contributions to C4s or C6s. Everyone says, but look at Target in Minnesota, where they gave money for issue advertising, and they were held accountable by their shareholders. Well, there's an easy answer to that, which is they gave money to a political committee registered with the state, which disclosed their contribution, And I can assure you that any general counsel worth his salt is now telling their corporate boards, don't give money to a public committee. Give to a C4 or a C6 so that you don't get into this sort of trouble. But despite what Justice Kennedy appears to have thought, there is not a way, as I understand it, under current corporate law, for shareholders to exercise the sort of control he expects them to exercise. Thanks very much.
Ms. Potter, thank you so much. We will now call on our final panelist, Dr. John Samples. Dr. Samples directs Cato's Center for Representative Government, which studies campaign finance regulation, delegation of legislative authority, and the political culture of limited government and civic virtues necessary for liberty. Dr. Samples is the author of The Struggle to Limit Government, A Modern Political History, and The Fallacy of Campaign Finance Reform. He teaches a course on constitutional interpretation for the Fund for American Studies at Georgetown University. And prior to joining Cato, he served 8 years as director of the Georgetown University Press. Before that, as vice president of the 20th Century Fund, and he received his PhD in political science from Rutgers University. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Samples.
First, I have to ask before I begin, does everyone have the article I brought with me by Mr. Franz, Professor Franz? Because that's going to be essential to my presentation. If not, do we have some more that could be given out so everyone has one? I'm going to start by giving Trevor a big hug because Trevor somewhere in the political spectrum and also identify myself a little bit more. I was at a congressional hearing this week, and it was an appropriations hearing, and in the course of it, it became very apparent that both the only two people there were the chairman and the ranking member. And they were both very, very unhappy, very exercised with Governor Rick Scott of Florida. And the reason why was, Governor Rick Scott wasn't going along quite as enthusiastically as he should have with the war on drugs, right? So, I think we have to, and I think that's a good thing, actually. I think the health care law and the federalism exists to give resistance to foolish public policies. So, Trevor, thanks for helping elect Governor Scott. And welcome also, would be welcome as a donor to the Cato Institute, if you like. You may have guessed by now that, related to what Trevor said, I'm not here representing the Republican Party, which I don't think is, by and large, interested in weakening or pulling back the war on drugs at all. What I want to do today more than anything, Cato is a libertarian institution. We've been supportive of liberalization of campaign finance laws. But today, I want to put on my hat as a political scientist, as a late addition to this, and talk a little bit about the whole issue of what actually happened and to the extent we can discern that. So what I decided to do actually was make use of someone else's work that has only recently came out. I came to a conference in January and heard this paper by Michael Franz, who is a political science professor. I want to make a couple of statements about it before I go into it. First of all, you may notice that this is drawn from a journal called The Forum, which is a political science journal. It's online. I've only given you about half of the paper here just for cost issues. So if you want to see the rest of this article, or I would recommend to you that you also read The Forum, which is a very interesting policy-oriented, concrete politics-oriented scholarly journal. You can go to it online, and you can download these articles for free, actually. You don't have to actually subscribe, although I suggest that you should, since my friend is the editor of it. This professor, the other second thing I want to say going in is Professor Franz is the author of this. I'm just presenting this in a fair use context. I know Michael Franz just through correspondence. He is not in any way associated with the Cato Institute. He doesn't work for the Cato Institute. I don't know if he would or would not agree with the Cato Institute about anything. This is a man who's written and worked in, but he is a highly regarded political scientist working in the campaign finance field. It's certainly true that what he's done here within a couple of months of the actual election is put together a great deal of data to try to get a first cut on what happened in 2010. I don't want to get into data quality issues. If you get the article, you can see that most of this is drawn from a unique database that he's associated with at Wesleyan University on television advertising. So with that, all, you know, don't blame friends. He's independent. Let's go in and look at actually what he found in this. And I would also say there's the rest of the article. You can download this stuff about disclosure and parties in there. But I wanted to get this particular part of it in. On page one, you got the basic sense on the advertising front, because that's the speech front most directly. 288 and 277 million in House and Senate together, about $110 million in ads in the final 60 days of the campaign by a variety of interest groups. Was this a number that's relatively large altogether? You look on page six and you see he tells you that interest groups in 2010 increased their advertising totals over 2008 by 168% in House races and by 44% in Senate races. These are dramatic spikes. On the other hand, levels of advertising increased from other sponsors, that is, from candidates in House races and Senate candidates by 61%. Now, so there's movement across the board. It was a high-profile, high-enthusiasm election. A lot was perceived to be at stake. I would add to, on the political side of things, political science side of this, is you, if you go back and look at a work by a guy named John Coleman from the 1990s, what he found was that these kinds of numbers are good for democracy. That is to say, high-spending races lead to better-informed voters. One article. The second article looked at these kinds of races and said not only do they lead to better informed voters in general, but voters who were less informed, relatively ignorant about incumbents and challengers, gained more from high spending races than the people who were already had some degree, a higher degree of political knowledge. So we see sharp spikes. The Coleman evidence from the past would lead you to think that that's a good thing because you're going to have better informed voters. Turn to page seven, where this is the overall percentage of ads sponsored by interest groups, television advertising. And indeed, you see a sharp spike, as you might expect, although he looks over time. And you see that these are not historic highs, although for the recent past, the last post-McCain-Feingold, they are highs. You're talking about a 6 to 12% range there. The 2010 number as an overall aggregate is the highest since 2002. But on the other hand, the 2000 race before McCain-Feingold, we notice a 17% of candidate ads. Now, there's a couple of ways to interpret that. There's a lot of variation. This is recent. This is a recent high, that's for sure. But another way to interpret this that is a little fraught with danger but could be true is that, and seems to be true on the face, is that McCain-Feingold's purpose was to reduce the overall percentage of these kinds of ads, these interest groups' ads, and if they had, and passing the law, as Fran says, was one of the points of passing McCain-Feingold was stop these ads. Well, then in fact it did. Now maybe the money went somewhere else. That's where you have to be careful. The money didn't necessarily go out of the system, or it could have been used in other ways. But it does look like the McCain-Feingold had a suppressive effect in that term, because you go from a height in 2000 in interest group spending, and then once it's removed with CU, you see an increase again. Whether that reflects, you think that's a success or a failure of McCain-Feingold depends on what you think about it, I suppose. But these were not historic highs in a certain sense, although they came close to it. And again, the other side of this whole thing is to keep in mind that given that all this is true, the interest groups became major players. They were major players, and they became even more so in the 2010 campaign. It's still true that candidates and parties in 2010 sponsored 85% of all ads in Senate races and 88% of ads in House races. Brands' comparison there, I think, is an interesting one, which, you know, 2010 was a big turnover election, but in a big turnover election, 86% of House candidates still get reelected, right? So you have a big, you have a relatively big changes, but it's not as if the system has been taken away from the party establishments or the traditional funders of these ads. Now, whether that's, again, a good or bad thing is an open question, but it certainly is not something that happened about what we can speak of. One of my points here, and indeed since it's 2011, the only thing we can speak about here is what happened in 2010. We don't know. The future is an unknown world, an unknown land, and we'll talk about it when we start having many more of these conferences in the future, I suppose. Now, into the further on, pages 10 and 11, go to a point that was mentioned during the campaign, but I don't think it's been mentioned today as far as I know. It's the partisan distribution. Very noticeable Republican spending associated with Mr. Rove and his allies, of course. But the point that's made here is that it depends on how you look at it. If by the end of the election, the Democratic committees and candidates had spent nearly $50 million more than Republicans, which may come as a surprise to you if you read, just remember back from last fall. The final totals were 159 and 112. Then, but that's not the end of the story, as usual. If you look beyond that, what happened is essentially is the Republican spending, while in certain ways they enjoyed an edge in Republican spending, the Democratic traditional sort of committee spending was much higher than the Republican. And at the end of the day, there was about a $20 million more in pro-Democratic ads in the 2010 cycle. So this was not a case where, despite the focus on Rove and his institutions and other giving, it was not one in which the Democratic Party, it didn't produce partisan effects that are often expected from this kind of spending. In fact, what you see is that in the end, the Democrats enjoyed a slight edge, as, by the way, they have traditionally for about the last decade or so. For the last decade or so, we've been in a world that was very different, actually, from the 1970s, 80s, and 90s in terms of partisan spending. And so the conclusion Franz gives you there on page 11 is, I think, correct. It kept the spending, the interest group spending, kept Republican challengers on pace and roughly equal with Republican incumbents, with Democratic incumbents. Now, the other thing you have to say about this is what happened last time, right? So without the interest groups, it's possible that the Democrats would have had a really big funding advantage. Now, it may well be that wouldn't matter all that much for reasons I'm going to tell you in a little bit. But still, it could have mattered some. But that doesn't tell you the future. If you have a Republican Senate, as you're likely to have after 2012, and a Republican House for at least a few cycles, it could be that what the Democrats used to enjoy an advantage will not be possible. On the other hand, it's also possible that, as we hear from news reports, that Democrats will get into this business too, and they've had a record of success in doing it. So we really can't say, I don't think, about what's going to happen there. Now, that is the way to think about it. We can't just conclude, though, that the Democrats are always going to be roughly equal with the Republicans, because the Democratic advantage was specific to this year, and it could be different in the future. Now, let's go to, this can't be a political science presentation without a plot, since we all want to be economists, and here we are, being economists. Page 13, what Franz tries to do here is tries to tease out in a way, did the spending make much difference? Did the spending make much difference, this kind of interest group corporate spending, or whatever it is, what we would call outside money on the advertising. He makes several points. If you look at basically the House and Senate here, if you look very, Senate's always tough to talk about, not many cases. But if you look at it, basically this is an attempt to talk about the effects of that spending. If you look, the x-axis here is spending without the interest group money included as a ratio, and then the y-axis is putting the interest group spending in. So you get the a sense of a ratio that's higher than one means that Republican interest groups were contributing something to the candidates. And as he points out, for almost every campaign in 2010, spending by interest groups benefited Republicans, right? Because that's what it means to be on the north side of the 45-degree line in this plot. However, at the same time, majority of the House races fall below the one, as you can see from the little box, on the on both axes. Now, what that means, even with the additional interest group spending, Republican candidates were being outgunned by Democratic candidates. This is all that sort of solid red and gray there inside that box means that, in fact, even though you had this interest group spending, in fact, the Democrats were probably spending more. But I think the crucial issue here is one that he talks about. The other thing to say is the races where the Republicans won a Democratic seat in this plot are displayed. The red triangles you see are what were a Republican takeover. Now, those races fall above the 45-degree line, which is to say that tells you, that sort of counts as evidence that this money went to a victory and replaced one of those 66 seats that changed hands. But so, as Franz points out, do most of the races, the Republicans. And in lots of the Republican pickups, he says, most of the totals, the overall spending, still benefited the Democrats. Now, this seems to me a strong piece of evidence. He says, if you take the mean difference off the 45-degree line for races held by Democratic incumbents, it's much higher. That is, the races where the Democratic incumbent won, that difference, is how much more the Republicans put into that. These were races, that number is much higher than in the cases where the Republicans had a pickup. That is to say, what he means by that is that Republicans put a lot of money in these races on average, and yet the Democrats still won. That would suggest that the effects of the interest group in this election, were fairly muted. And that's what the plot suggests, and the difference in means. Now, again, it could be very specific to this election, but that's what the evidence suggests. Now, before I run completely out of time, I want to go on and say one other thing, which is, well, how do we understand the election, which I think this is the most important thing, which is that don't think about the money. And so I talk briefly here about David Brady's and Doug Rivers have an article out where they point out that I can go through it, and I wanted to, but I'm out of time. But let me just say it. Basically, 66 seats turn in the House. Their statistical analysis of the data suggests that about 40 to 44 of the seats are caused by the economy, and about 22 to somewhere north of 25, 26 are caused by the health care bill and maybe a little bit by the cap and trade, but mostly the health care bill. These were, the economy was maybe beyond the control or not of the president and his party. The health care bill was definitely a choice. The money had some effect. It was an interaction effect with those decisions. But actually, that kind of framework was really the way to understand, I think, the election, and not the interest group spending. I've got other things to say, but I'm out of time. So maybe even questions.
Dr. Samples, thank you so much, and all of our panelists for a superb presentation. Before opening it up to the audience, I would like to throw just two general questions if I might. The first of those questions really relates to the specifics that we were focused on, which is the direct impact of Citizens United. And the question I would have is, why is it relevant legally or constitutionally if we determine that, in fact, one party or another party was, in fact, favored by the changes in this? Would any member of the panel actually make a legal or constitutional argument that the legislature ought to, in fact, enact legislation, that we should have a requirement of equal expenditures of both parties, or that, in fact, you believe it would be constitutional to have such legislation? And I would note that 9 days from today, there is an oral argument before the Supreme Court of the United States, as I expect our panel knows, in the Arizona Free Enterprise case, which will, in fact, be looking at the constitutionality, likely, of a public finance system in Arizona that has a very substantial requirement of equality provision, of a matching provision to offset privately raised funds. So we may be getting at that. So that's the first question. Why, in a sense, is it legally relevant if we determine, though clearly a policy interest, why is it legally relevant, if it is at all? Any member of the panel care to seek to respond to that?
I'm glad you jumped forward to McComish, because I think it'll be interesting to see how the court builds on Citizens United there. In Citizens United, the majority took the position that what's important is speech, not the source of the speech, and that listeners have a right to hear speech, and that that's a constitutional value. The argument that the defense of the Arizona statute is going to make is that what we have here is more speech. We have the state of Arizona providing additional funds to candidates so that the citizens will hear more speech. And so it'll be interesting to see what the court does in squaring its earlier logic with that.
Any other comments on that? Thank you, Trevor.
I don't think in current doctrine that there's much of a legal point. I've always talked about it because, I mean, I don't see, this is the Journal of Law and Politics. Well, there's a political point, which is, I remember, and I think Mark will correct me if I remember incorrectly, at one point, and when the going got dodgy on McCain-Feingold, Richard Gephardt was reported to say out loud or to a Post reporter, "They'll always outraise us," right? And so there was a sort of a belief that, you know, people were having trouble. Should the Democrats vote for McCain-Feingold now that we really actually have to? We're sort of falling into this situation. And people were saying, well, no. And Gephardt's response was, but they'll always outraise us, which suggested to me that was the moment I said, well, you know, there's two things, really. One, that motivate campaign finance regulation: partisan interest and incumbent interest. Incumbent interest is a constant. It's built into the system. But partisan interest can change. If there's no gap between the parties, you're very unlikely to get campaign finance regulation out of Congress. That's my thesis.
Any other comments?
Yeah, I guess I would disagree with a couple of pieces of this. First of all, I agree that there's no there is not likely to be, and nor does the Arizona statute envision an equality of speech rationale. A couple of things. First of all, I'm not sure I totally disagree with the data. I may disagree with the conclusion of the data. I don't know where the data comes from. But if the suggestion is that outside group spending A was matched by the Democratic Party using its own money, okay, but that just meant the Democratic Party had less money to spend on other things like get out the vote and non-ads. So sure, that doesn't mean that the outside group spending on the Republican side didn't have an impact, but what it simply means is that it drew resources from the Democratic Party that would have otherwise gone to other things so that it could match outside group spending. The second is that to the extent the data is meant to suggest that money is not the most important thing, or didn't decide dozens of congressional seats. Well, you know, in a world in which we live, where the Congress is within a few dozen seats one way or the other, if it decided 10 seats or 5 seats or 15 seats, where it may have been the marginal player, that's still something significant. But I come back to where I started with, which is, honestly, I'm not sure I understand the bashfulness. I mean, Karl Rove didn't do this to waste his time, right? He didn't do this to, at the end of it, have people say, you know what, all that spending, all that fundraising you did, all that hard work you did putting that together with you and Norm Coleman and Crossroads, and you know, it really didn't matter. I mean, if they thought it didn't matter, they wouldn't have done it, and they wouldn't be doing it again. So,
I didn't do that great disclaimer at the front end of this because Michael Franz is a conservative. I did it because I don't know for sure, but I suspect Michael Franz is not a conservative.
I wasn't suggesting Michael. I don't know Michael Franz, so I wasn't. Right. I wasn't suggesting one way or the other what his ideology.
But you're suggesting that that's sort of the backing away and not claiming the credit for it. Here we have a person who's just working the data saying not much happened. And by the way, the rest of the article does go to the end. This is what cheapness, unwillingness to spend money on paper. He goes to the independent group question and shows that doesn't work.
Okay, well, like I said, I've read the whole article, and I wasn't actually offering critique of him. Of his article, his data, or his analysis, because I haven't read the full article. I've only skimmed what during your presentation.
So. Trevor, last one on this point, and since there's been a robust discussion here, I'm going to forego my second question and open it to the audience. But first, your point, Trevor.
Well, this goes back to, I think, your original question and the one that John Samples just spoke on, and that is the question of whether campaign finance legislation is inherently an act of incumbent protection. I have a couple quick reactions to that. One, as a veteran of the McCain-Feingold wars, I almost start laughing because it was, I think, fairly an insurgent movement in both parties. The entire Republican establishment hated the idea because they liked the money they had. That was almost true of the Democratic establishment. And those listening outside the keyholes of the Democratic caucus meetings, and in some cases invited in to make the case, reported that there was a robust discussion in the Democratic caucus about whether they were shooting themselves in both feet by supporting this, and wasn't it true that the party was going to do badly from it. So I think the establishment was against it. It was in many ways an insurgency fueled by outside entities. Now, you may consider editorial boards to be themselves a different part of the establishment, but they were not the incumbents. So I thought that it... My reaction is that McCain-Feingold was largely not incumbent protection. Having said that, I have a general question to ask, which we won't resolve today, which is, you know, who else is going to legislate on this in a federal system? And it's the real question. In states, you have referenda. You have ways for citizens to get issues on the ballot, and a lot of campaign finance legislation comes through citizen initiative. We don't have that at the federal level. If you want to change any piece of the campaign finance law, if you are in favor of public funding, if you think there shouldn't be disclosure in the statute, you have to deal with Congress, which means the reality of two political parties and 535 incumbents. So whether you're tightening it or loosening it, you're still going to have to deal with that structure. I think the Supreme Court, that's one reason the court has had these tightly drawn arguments in McConnell and Citizens United over the statute, is that the justices look at it in different ways and over the amount of deference they're willing to give Congress because Congress is regulating in elections and legislation that directly affects them.
Trevor, might a partial response to that be, whatever the debate within the Congress, a majority of the members of Congress passed it. A majority of members of Congress voted for it. And you yourself actually in that statement have indicated there is a fundamental conflict of interest of members of Congress dealing, wanting to remain incumbents, having a particular view on their particular political party and whether it will be helped or not in voting on it. And I don't suggest there's any other way to make laws in our constitutional system, but it does seem to me when you look at the question of the extent to which these are likely to to protect incumbents as opposed to oppose incumbents, it is more reasonable to assume that when a majority of the legislatures vote for them, they will be more likely to protect incumbents.
Or that they accede to the loud wishes of people banging on their doors, even though they're not sure it's really in their self-interest.
That, absolutely, and it is a political process. They may be responding to outside political pressure. Good point. Let's open it up at this point. Yes, sir. Anyone like to deal with that? Did this, for example, to perhaps put a gloss on that, did this help Tea Party candidates, for example, particularly over other segments in the Republican Party, or the same thing in left or right of the Democratic spectrum?
I think one thing you can say, just to take a stab at it, is 2010 was marked by a lot of candidates from outside the system. And that probably, on the Senate side, people have noted that probably hurt the Republican Party. They probably lost about 3 seats that they would otherwise have won. But then that raises the question, how did that happen? Because, you know, maybe, I mean, the first answer might be outside money, but it's about, you know, still 85 to 89%, something like that, still coming from the party committees and candidates and so on. So it's... maybe in those cases it could. You can't make individual conclusions about aggregate results. But I think also what I was trying to make the point about the Brady thing is this was a big atmosphere here. The money is always part of the atmosphere. It rarely has independent effects in itself, although Mark would want to identify certain races where it did. But generally speaking, the big story was not the money. Things I mentioned. That's how you get people get selected. They happen, and then they win the party candidate.
And I would just add very briefly, by the way, I should have started with the same disclaimer that my two colleagues have, which is, lest anyone think I speak for the Democratic Party, I'm here only as an individual speaking for myself. I have lots of clients who have different views on these matters, ranging from one end of the spectrum to the other. So I think that two things. One, I'm not sure you and I disagree all that much. Again, I'm not saying that it's the dominant factor in any election. It's a situation of election cycles where the macro environmental forces simply matter more or less relative to campaign spending. I do think money matters in elections. In some places, it may be not that it is the dominant factor in race, but it is the difference between. Much like Pope did, you know, maybe the difference between 1,000 votes or 4,000 votes, and in a winner-take-all system, those small effects will have decisive impact. So, the fact that it may have been decisive in particular races doesn't even mean it was dominant in those races. It just means that it played a significant enough role that it may have impacted. On the very very direct answer to your question, the only race that I'm aware of on the Democratic side where I would say that's true, I know less about. Dynamics of what moved the Republican primary was probably the Arkansas Senate race, where the incumbent Democratic senator was the subject of significant spending coming from within the party. In other words, it was largely organized labor and other progressive interests running ads attacking Senator Lincoln. Now, whether that ultimately made the difference in the general election or not, who knows? But that's the only example that immediately comes to mind of where it affected the primary.
We have time for, I think, maybe 3 more questions. I have one here, and then Lane Needler, and then this gentleman here. Yes, sir.
Well, I'll just address the second part of it. Where to find the data? I don't know what. Okay. You know, Congress last cycle, there was a move afoot to pass a bill that would have had the impact of disclosing more fully where the funding came from. It was called the Disclose Act. It had, and I rarely correct Commissioner McGann, but it actually had Republican, I believe it had a Republican co-sponsor in the House. Congressman Castle co-sponsored it with Congressman Van Hollen. Senate, and it passed the House. The Senate failed to overcome filibuster. Where we go from there, we'll see. We'll see whether there is another effort, either by the Republican House or in the Senate.
Inherent in the question, of course, is the conundrum, because somewhere in the middle of that you uttered the line, how do we find out where this money came from? And the point is, we don't. Because of the non-disclosure, we don't in fact know where much of the money came from that was spent by the outside groups. There's a discussion about how much corporate money was spent. We have no idea if any corporate money was spent by the groups that aren't disclosing. So the short answer is that there are a range of organizations that have accumulated the data that is available. And I was using report by Public Citizen, which is www.citizen.org, and they looked at what was on the FEC record and also 527 spending. The Sunlight Foundation has been mentioned, and they have done a fair amount of aggregating of spending. Those are the two that I know of.
I don't know if you were asking about my data, but Franz's data comes from you could Google the Wesleyan Media Project and the Wisconsin Advertising Project. They keep data. I have a prediction, though. I'm going to make a scientific prediction here. If you look at McCain-Feingold, what you notice is in both cases that it got over the top because you had about 90% Democratic support in the final roll calls, an important roll call. And then you were able to gain about 20% of the Republican caucus in both houses. And if you look at those Republicans, what you find is they tend to be, I think, the average George W. Bush number in their districts in the House in 2000 was about 50. That is, these were very competitive districts on average. Not all of them, but on average. So I think the prediction would be if we go through another couple of cycles and there are Republican representatives in districts that Barack Obama won or John Kerry won, they will be people who might consider disclosure, voting yes on disclosure for a variety of reasons. And the other thing about people from those districts is they tend to be they have ideological differences, too. So we may get it, just as that's what I would expect, but it's a re-election issue.
Professor Nadler.
Against harm or what was
against disclosure.
Threats and harm.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at this morning with my question to the first panel, which is you have to step back. The position that disclosure, which is, after all, mandated disclosure, Commissioner McGann mentioned, what is the sort of spirit of the American Constitution? The spirit is that the presumption is government has to give reasons. It's not, they're not just good things. The idea that disclosure is just a good thing is not a good start. So then you ask the questions why. Corruption is one. And the other is education of the voters. So I'm going to get to the point here in a minute, which is this. If for independent spending, if education or information for the voters is the only real rationale, then, for example, as the Disclose Act did, forcing corporate leaders or interest group leaders to disclose their names is irrelevant. It's not relevant to, because why? Voters aren't going to get any information out of that. They don't know who these people are. Now, it's true if you identify them as CEO XYZ Corporation, they'll get information out of XYZ Corporation, right? They'll get that information. And someone mentioned on one of the panels, maybe you could focus disclosure on that. But I guess the other argument against it is, what is the purpose served here, and how does the actual legislation, under even a heightened scrutiny, how does it fit to it? And I think we're in a different world if in independent spending.
And the last question?
I am not a tax lawyer. I only play one when I go to my law firm, which is a tax law firm. and so I can safely say in the presence of the Kaplan Auditorium that the one thing I have learned about tax law is that it's much more complicated than any other area of law. And that's a real answer. I think it is unlikely that the IRS is going to be the agency that cuts through the Gordian knot of disclosure here. There will be arguments every which way over whether these groups met the correct standard or not. Once you get through all of those arguments, which will take a very long time, in an agency that I think is in many ways underfunded and risk adverse because they don't want to be in the middle of this partisan battleground if they can avoid it. At the end of all that, you will then have a remedies question. And it turns out that a clever tax lawyer will explain to you that if they didn't qualify as a C4, the result may be they have to pay an excise tax, not that they have to disclose their donors. And even if they had to disclose their donors, it would be years after the election. So I'm familiar with the complaints. My colleagues may have a different view of the efficacy of the IRS here, but I can only say I think the complaints I've read raise good legal questions that will be resolved in due course, which will be a while from now, but I don't think the effect of those complaints will actually result in a significant change in behavior and disclosure. Sarah.
At the risk of answering a different question, posing the question at the end of the symposium, which are two risks I'm taking. My part of what I find curious about the disclosure debate is that I believe, I could be mistaken, this is part of my question to my two colleagues here, that for years, what the Republican argument, the Republican establishment argument, the non-establishment, the Mitch McConnell Republican campaign finance establishment argument was, let unlimited money, but have it be disclosed. And I cannot cite you in a specific instance of this, but I can vividly recall sitting in rooms in which Republican operatives and lawyers and representatives of the Republican Party or people who have affiliation with the Republican Party were tripping over themselves. We'll have instant disclosure. It'll be on the internet. It will be super duper disclosure. If only we could have unlimited money. Disclosure will be the king. This will be the solution. And I believe, and then I will end with a question mark. I even believe that the 527 disclosure bill, which was passed in the late 90s, was passed, I believe, by 2000, I believe, at a time when the Republicans actually controlled Congress, and it was not an 80% Democrat plus 20% Republican. I could be misremembering this, but I believe it was actually a It was the Republicans leading that charge. So I'm just curious if there is a, if there's been some intellectual awakening that has gone on in the last few months or years within the Republican Party that, you know, they didn't invite me to observe or participate in for understandable reasons.
Well, I was thinking of major pieces of legislation, but that, because I actually forgotten about that one. I thought you were going to raise the question of the Disclose Act, which was because Republicans were beaten over the head for having been all in favor of disclosure and then not being in favor of the Disclose Act. The Disclose Act had two parts. One was extensive disclosure, and other parts were prohibitions. And it turned out, the thing about campaign finance reform that's interesting is people actually sometimes say what's actually going on and it gets quoted in the papers and no one notices. And, which is the Gephardt thing is one example. But there was this, Bruce Ackerman says, you know what you can do? You can ban spending by all the government contractors and by foreign nationals and you'll get the Fortune 500. So you'll just reinstate. You could overturn Citizens United without overturning it, which is the way Congress likes to confront the court. They don't like direct confrontations generally. They like to go around. And they didn't get a vote on that. I suspect, yes, you are correct. He is correct that disclosure or a disclosure-only regime was frequently defended during that period. And I suspect, as I said earlier, under the certain amounts of certain conditions, you would probably get a fair number of Republican votes. But we have not yet seen that condition. We saw a attempt to overturn Citizens United.
Before asking the audience to join me in thanking our panelists, I would like to read a quote from the closing paragraph, the ending quote, of Professor Larry Sabato's testimony to the Senate of the United States in the aftermath of McCain-Feingold. And before reading the quote, let me again put this in context. We are talking about something that's enormously important in our democratic political process, that is the integrity and the operation of the electoral system and how that process works. Here is the challenge that was left, I think, for all of us, whatever one's view on this, from Professor Sabato, who's been a careful observer of this for some time. He writes, "The post-Watergate presidential system is not a model that ought to serve as an ideal standard, but rather a real-world experiment that has demonstrated the folly of many campaign reforms and regulations. To me, the presidential system's Rube Goldberg structure and operations have proven that the wise Hippocratic oath should be applied to political reform, quote, first, do no harm." Thank you very much, and thank you, all our panelists.